IB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Kabul bombing reveals a cadre of generals who lack the courage to admit the dishonor of killing civilians, says Peter Mossrider in an article titled, America's Generals Are Cowards. Fire Them All. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. If you are waiting for an American general to resign or be fired over the drone strike that killed 7 children and 3 men in Kabul last month, you will likely experience the meaning of infinity. You might think that the Pentagon would be scrambling to find a general to take the fall for what can no longer be denied, that the U.S. military killed 10 Afghans on August 29th, called it a righteous strike against terrorists, and then had to admit the truth after journalists found out what happened. The military is already saying that standard targeting protocols were followed for the Kabul attack. The problem was a faulty assumption or two, we meant well, next time we will do better. The generals are in a corner. If they admit that the Kabul massacre is resignation worthy, and in a healthy society a massacre would be, they would have to admit that resignations should have occurred after the multitude of U.S. bombings and attacks in the past 20 years that killed large numbers of civilians, doing nothing more sinister than attending a wedding party, seeking care at a hospital, or picking pine nuts. The Kabul bombing was an outlier only in the amount of attention it received. The killing of civilians has proven to be a feature rather than a bug of the 9/11 wars. The generals who have overseen two decades of carnage in Afghanistan and Iraq are inept at winning wars, but they possess one skill in abundance, a knack for avoiding career consequences for their too-many-to-count errors. The generals, as well as the politicians who approve ever-rising military budgets, have managed to lull the country to sleep with a euphemistic lullaby about what they want us to limply understand as a frequent phenomenon of collateral damage. The lack of resignations, whether forced or voluntary, attests to a character trait that is not traditionally attached to U.S. generals, but should be. Cowardice. Let's focus on moral cowardice. Since 2001, not a single general has had the courage to say, enough, I will not be part of this killing and deception any longer. It is wrong and harmful to all. Here are my stars. Again and again, the generals have tolerated, excused, and lied about the slaughter of civilians in the 9/11 wars. At least several hundred thousand non-combatants have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the number is probably far higher. What happened in Kabul last month is a case study of those pathologies of denial poured into one tragedy. Courage is required to admit that you were dead wrong, to take an unpopular stand against your brethren, to cast shame on them, and to bring under approval. Courage is also necessary to sustain an objector in the aftermath of breaking away. Though a dissenting general would retire with a generous pension, he could forget about landing the lucrative corporate gigs, usually with military contractors that shower millions of dollars on former commanders who lend their prestige to forever warfare. In other words, it doesn't require a ridiculous amount of courage for a general to do the right thing. We have to look elsewhere, far below the military's upper echelons, to find the courage that ending 20 years of unlawful warfare requires. Look, for example, to Daniel Hale, who worked on the intelligence side of drone warfare for the Air Force and came to be repulsed by it. In 2015, Hale leaked classified military documents that revealed the underside of U.S. drone program and, in particular, the weaknesses of its targeting protocols and its tendency to kill people who are not the intended targets. The Intercept published classified documents about the problems in the U.S. drone program in an 8-part series in late 2015. Hales has explained, "With drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. You have to kill part of your conscience to do your job. I stole something that was never mine to take, precious human life. I couldn't keep living in a world in which people pretend that things weren't happening that were." Today, Hale is not pulling down 6 figures a year as a board member of Raytheon Technologies or Lockheed Martin. He is serving a 45-month prison sentence for violating the Espionage Act. Of course, getting rid of the senior leadership of armed forces would be an incredibly radical move, but Andrew Bacevich has put forward a plan to do just that. Bacevich is a retired Army colonel who in recent decades emerged as one of the most prominent intellectual critics of American foreign and military policy. On the 20th anniversary of 9/11, he published a lightly noticed article proposing a wholesale clearance of the nation's military leadership due to their losing streak. Its winking title was a modest proposal: fire all of the post-9/11 generals. But Bacevich stressed that his piece was not a Swiftian satire. "Allow me to suggest a purge," he wrote. "Oblige all active duty 3- and 4-star generals and admirals to retire forthwith. Rebuild the ranks of the senior officer corps with members of a younger generation willing and able to acknowledge the shortcomings of recent American military leadership at the top." To find the replacements, Bacevich suggested that the Secretary of Defense, though not the current one, Lloyd Austin, who was a 4-star general until recently, personally interview 1- and 2-star generals who show promise and ask this one question. "On a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is lousy, 10 excellent, and 5 mediocre, how would you rate U.S. military performance over the past 20 years? Generals who give a rating of 5 or below would proceed to the next round, consisting of writing an essay in 2 hours that answers the question. What is the problem and how do we fix it?" Bacevich concluded, "Those essays should provide the basis for selecting and assisting the next generation of senior leaders. There is no need to wonder whether the next generation will be better than the present one, because Bacevich's plan is not going to be adopted. The generals don't want it, and the politicians don't want it. Americans are stuck with a cadre of military leaders who lack the courage to admit the dishonor of killing civilians around the world." communique.
The safe. That's what the Israelis call the maximum security prison in Gilboa. Well, it doesn't seem like much of a safe anymore. Six Palestinian men have escaped from there in what is effectively the most notorious jailbreak of the last 20 years. And while Israelis have launched a giant manhunt trying to clear out the embarrassment, Palestinians have been celebrating the escape as an act of defiance against the occupation and a much-needed boost of morale. So how did they do it, you ask? How did six men tunnel out of an Israeli maximum security prison? Well, they did it using a spoon, of course. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. In the early hours of Monday morning on September 6th, a daring prison escape took place in cell number 5, wing 2 of the Israeli maximum security prison in Gilboa. Nicknamed The Safe, six Palestinian men broke out of their prison cell through a hole under the shower using a tunnel that they had dug with a rusty spoon. Gilboa Prison was built back in 2004 and sits 6 kilometers away from the West Bank and just 16 kilometers from the Jordanian border. This is where Palestinians are sent to serve long and even life sentences. Considered one of the occupation's toughest prisons, the cells do not even have windows. The escapees dug a tunnel around 22 meters long for several months before finally escaping on September 6th at around 1 a.m. The prison didn't even know there had been an escape until locals reported seeing something suspicious to the occupation authorities, who then informed the prison. And by the time they did a head count and realized six prisoners were missing, 3 hours had already passed. Now, the six men who escaped are Mahmoud Arida, incarcerated since 1996, life in prison; Muhammad Arida, incarcerated since 2002, life in prison; Ayhan Kamanji, incarcerated since 2006, life in prison; Yaqub Qadri, incarcerated since 2003, life in prison; Zakaria Zubaydi, in prison since 2019, awaiting trial; Munad al-Nufayat, incarcerated since 2019, without charge. Now, five of the men are members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Meanwhile, Zakaria Zubaydi, perhaps the most famous of the six, was a former commander of the Al-Aqsa Marches Brigade and a very prominent figure in the Palestinian resistance. His mother was killed by an Israeli sniper, as was his brother, and their home demolished 3 times by the Israelis. On the morning of the escape, videos emerged showing the Israeli prison guards examining the tunnel which the prisoners had dug. And the fact that 6 Palestinian resistance fighters had outsmarted one of the Israelis' most highly secured prisons with literally a spoon drew laughter and mockery online as people compared the prison break to movies like Shawshank Redemption and flooded the internet with memes. Now, in Western movies and media, the Israelis always love to portray themselves as extremely intelligent and competent, perpetuating this myth that they are smarter than everyone else and they are the best in technology and security. Well, it turns out all that was needed to defeat one of their maximum security prisons were 6 determined Palestinians and 1 spoon, a rusty spoon, which they hid behind a poster, hence the comparisons to Shawshank. Not only that, but the men also managed to evade 40 guards, 3 watchtowers, 2 walls, barbed wires, security cameras, and a pack of sniffer dogs. The Israelis, of course, didn't find the jokes very funny and launched a manhunt instead in an attempt to capture the men. And when news of the escape broke, many towns and cities in Palestine erupted in celebration, with people handing out sweets in the street. Both Hamas and Fatah celebrated the escape, calling on Palestinians to protect and aid the escapees. Most of the men actually come from Jenin, which is located not too far from the prison. And residents of their hometown erupted in celebration, as did Palestinians in Gaza, Jerusalem, the West Bank, and all over, heralding the six as heroes. Protests were also held in solidarity with those who are still incarcerated, after Israel, in response, imposed punitive measures, such as moving prisoners of Islamic Jihad into different prisons, closing the prisoner shop, which sells basic necessities. The Israelis also limited the number of prisoners allowed in the yard at any given time and reduced the time they're allowed to spend outside to just 1 hour a day. Now, this whole incident was such an embarrassment for the Israelis, they even began arresting the family members of the escaped men as a form of collective punishment, detaining at least 7 family members. And this reminds us of last year when the Israelis killed Iyad Hallah, a 32-year-old Palestinian man. He was autistic, and after the Israeli forces killed him in cold blood, they raided his parents' house in an attempt to find something incriminating and intimidate his family. Meanwhile, the Israeli media has begun offering a myriad of responses as to why this escape happened. First, they say that the blueprints for the prison were posted online by the architecture firm that built the prison. That firm's website is subsequently gone offline. Israeli media also reported that perhaps one of the guards had fallen asleep, or that the prisoners maybe had someone helping them on the inside or the outside. All these wild explanations, except the very obvious one, that they had simply been outsmarted and defeated by the six freedom fighters. Now, despite the success of the escape and finally being free and able to breathe in the fresh air of Palestine again, this freedom was to be short-lived, unfortunately. A few days later, on the night of September 10th, four of the escaped men were captured by Israeli forces, just a few hours apart. Yaqub Qadri and Mahmoud Arida were detained just a few hours later near the town of Shibli Amel Ghanam. And in the early morning hours of September 19th, the last two men, Kamamji and Nufayat, were detained by Israeli forces near their hometown of Jenin. And of course, one of the first things the occupation does is post photographs of the men in handcuffs on social media in order to show off and posture, and more importantly, before they've been beaten and tortured, for they surely wouldn't post those pictures, would they? And while the Israeli media calls the men terrorists, it's quite ironic, given that Zakaria Zubeidi has been waiting 2 years for a trial, and Munad al-Dufayat hasn't even been charged with the crime, let alone convicted. And of course, the other four are only terrorists in the eyes of the occupying power because they dared to resist, and they surely didn't receive fair trials. Although there were rumors online and in the Israeli media that the captured men had been turned in to the occupation forces by other Palestinians, this is false. This claim was refuted by one of the escapees, Muhammad Larida, who insisted that no one had reported them or turned them in. It was simply bad luck, as they were spotted by an Israeli patrol. The escapees never interacted with anyone, never asked for assistance, precisely to avoid the Israelis exacting revenge on others. Indeed, it was widely feared that were the men to be recaptured, they would face severe punishment at the hands of the Israelis. And this, unfortunately, proved to be true. A photograph of Zakaria Zubeidi shows his face completely swollen from the beatings after being arrested. Zakaria was beaten and tortured so badly that he had to be transferred to a hospital, to the intensive care unit. His brother has told the media that it is very difficult to get any news or updates about his health, as this is being kept secret by the Israelis. Later on, the occupation court decided to extend the detention of the four escapees who had been recaptured, and even blocked them from meeting with their lawyers, making it difficult to check on their health and well-being. Zakaria's defense lawyer, Avidor Feldman, told the Associated Press that Zakaria was taken to hospital and given painkillers because of fractures to his jaw and two of his ribs after being beaten up during arrest. Muhammad Arida, who was captured alongside Zakaria, was also severely beaten during arrest before being taken to a police station and stripped naked for interrogation. As of now, the four escapees are being held by the Shin Bet in another prison and put through excruciating interrogations that last all day. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, joining me on the program from Jerusalem is Palestinian politician, activist, and scholar Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. She served as an official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process, and until last year, as a senior member of the PLO Executive Committee. She held several posts within the Palestinian Authority, the Arab League, as well as the PLO. As an activist, she founded several bodies and institutions dedicated to Palestinian self-determination, such as the Independent Commission for Human Rights. Dr. Ashrawi, it's an honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you, Richard.
Doctor, can I just begin perhaps a bit more broadly with the West now marking the anniversary of the so-called Abraham Accords. What do you make of that? And what are your thoughts on the current state of the resistance? I mean, do you think that in the last month since Al-Aqsa and everything that's happened since, do you believe that the resistance is headed in the right direction?
Yeah, well, the celebration of Abraham Accords is really a very cynical manipulation of a very bad situation in which the conflict is perpetuated with the complicity and collusion of some Arab countries or some Arab regimes that were either blackmailed or bribed into normalizing with Israel, which means normalizing the occupation and injustice and lawlessness and so on. That's another issue we can talk about for a long time. Palestinian resistance is ongoing. It has never stopped. The question is, what shape does it take? What expression does it adopt? It adopts many shapes, many expressions, and basically it is firmly embedded in the Palestinian people's refusal to surrender.
And the recent escape by the six men from Gilboa, what does that mean particularly for the resistance? Why is this escape so important in its timing, its scale, and its nature, and how does it play into everything that we just talked about?
The most significant aspect of this latest phase is, of course, the expression of total unity among the younger generation of all Palestinians everywhere. Well, the six liberated or self-liberated prisoners have captured the imagination of the Palestinian people, and actually of the world, of people of conscience. These are Palestinians unjustly imprisoned in many cases and unlawfully kept within prisons in Israel and judged by a military court of the occupation. So, and kept in one of the most secure prisons in Israel, Gilboa, and they managed persistently and in an amazing way to dig this tunnel, to be able to find their way to freedom. It gave the Palestinians a sense of hope, a boost of morale, that even Israel's most militarily secured location is not immune to the Palestinian spirit and yearning to be free. This was the most important message. And all the Palestinian people united defending them, supporting them, and expressing a sense of solidarity and appreciation, while expressing also our yearning to be free. There are different types of activity, of captivity, but as you know, all of Palestine is being held captive by Israel.
You know, we saw the Israeli media say that the prison's blueprints were left online by the architecture firm that built the prison. They said there were also problems with the plumbing system that were exploited. They even suggested that one of the guards simply fell asleep or was working with the prisoners. I mean, we've heard a whole host of reasons from the Israelis. Do you think that perhaps they're just coming up with excuses to try and cover up their embarrassment?
Of course. Yeah, this is typical. They're always trying to diminish the achievements of Palestine and the Palestinian people. They're always trying to say, well, something went wrong, or one person is responsible, or whatever. But the issue is that there is this dedication, there is this total commitment to achieving their freedom, to seeing their families, to, as one person said, 5 days smelling the fresh air of Palestine, of looking at Palestine, of eating some of the fruits and so on, is equal to a lifetime in prison. This is the kind of spirit, undefeated spirit, of the Palestinian people. And this is something that is not consistent with the Israeli narrative and with the Israeli misrepresentation of the Palestinians. As you know, historically, Israel always labeled all Palestinians as terrorists, and so it goes on and on and on. They never say Palestinian unless they add the term terrorist to it. So the denial of the humanity, the denial of the spirit, the denial of the dedication of the real human nature of the Palestinian people and narrative, this now is not so credible, given the fact that reality is coming out, that people have a chance to look at what's happening, to address the Palestinians directly, to utilize social media and other means in order to debunk the myths and expose the lies of Israel.
Hamas announced that there will be no prisoner exchanges in the future with the Israelis unless they include the six men from Gilboa, essentially that they will be free in any case. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that really encouraged Palestinian people, because these six deserve to be free. And we believe all Palestinians deserve to be free, that all Palestinian political prisoners and Israeli prisons are being held unlawfully and unjustly. But in any prisoner exchange, certainly, they, as well as others like Marwan Barghouti and Hamad Saadat and others, have to be released. So the fact is that they paid the price of their captivity, so to speak, and they showed the world how they can break the walls of their prison, how they can defy the conditions of their injustice. So certainly, yes, they should be at the top of the list.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you, the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar reported from an unnamed source that the Palestinian Authority had agreed to help the Israelis catch the men in exchange for easing of prison conditions. Do you think this report is credible, and what are your thoughts on it?
No, I would like to check the source, frankly speaking. I don't know who told this to Al-Akhbar. It has to be credible, because I don't believe that there's any Palestinian who will betray these people, whether the leadership or among the people. And everybody, including the government and the presidency, everybody expressed solidarity with the prisoners, with the liberated prisoners, with those still in prison, and they maintained their commitment to them. So I don't think that anybody would betray them in any way, no.
Right, I also wasn't sure if it's an attempt to sow discord, as they were also putting other stories out and so on.
Of course, they attempted to say that they were handed over or betrayed by other Palestinians in villages and so on. So, as usual, the source of information should never be Israel.
Why is it important for people to understand, to acknowledge that the men who the self-liberated men, you know, they're freedom fighters, they're resistance fighters, not just morally, ethically, but indeed legally under international law?
It is important because, as I said, Israel has been trying to distort and malign the Palestinian struggle as a whole and the Palestinian people, including individuals and freedom fighters and so on. Look, Israel has arrested over a million people since 1967 only, Palestinians. And has killed over 75,000 Palestinians. Does that mean Israel has found a nation of terrorists? Does it mean that Israel has a system of justice for its people under its occupation and held in captivity? Does it mean that the Israeli military courts and the Israeli laws and occupiers' laws and so on hand out justice to the Palestinian people? These are occupiers who are using every possible means, including utter lawlessness and violence, against a captive population. And then they give themselves the right to arrest, to detain, to kill, extrajudicial killings, and so on, and to brand everybody who defies its oppression and occupation as a terrorist. So placing things in context, contextualizing reality of these prisoners or self-liberating. Actually, people remain free inside, even though you are held in captivity. So to try to malign them and to try to justify why they're there and to try once again, I mean, the way they were treated when they were caught, it's just horrendous. The way they were beaten, the way they were insulted and abused and so on, it's horrific. But this is the nature of Israeli occupation and a settler colonial regime that is based on pure, unadulterated racism. Hmm? Racism, Islamophobia, denial of the humanity of the other, using any means of control in order to be able to maintain a stronghold and to steal the land and resources, as well as the narrative and reality and identity of the Palestinian people.
One of the prisoners, Zakaria Zubaydi, we heard that he's been treated so badly, beaten up so badly by the Israelis that he was sent to the intensive care unit and there's a media blackout on his health condition. Do we have any news on that front about how he's doing, or is this blackout still in place?
I think his lawyer came out and talked about how he was beaten up and broken bones and his face and his head was. So news is coming out, and it comes through Palestinian lawyers or people who are able to reach him, and there are not many. I think only one person was able to reach him. But when you look at the photos of his arrest and the ways in which they tried to cover him up so that he won't be seen, the army, the soldiers were surrounding him, but you could see his face, and they said his face, his head. And of course he had previous injuries, so they targeted these injuries in the legs and so on. And the whole history of Zakaria's baby, the way they killed his mother by an Israeli sniper, killed his father, arrested and killed many of his siblings and so on. It's just a history of tragedies, a history of willful, deliberate cruelty and murder, actually. And he hasn't been tried, by the way. He has been held for years. Because when you don't have evidence, this administrative detention is just horrific. They don't have evidence. They just want to punish somebody for no reason. It is part of the Israeli mindset and the occupation. And so the story of Zakaria must be told and must be understood in its context. And the film that was made, Arna's Children, talks about a bit of his history. But at the same time, his family and his extended family and community and Jenin and the refugee camp in Jenin, as well as all of Palestine, it encapsulates this story of Zakaria, encapsulates the most horrific injustices imposed on the Palestinian people, and must be seen, must be heard, must be read in order to understand the true nature of this settler colonial regime and this apartheid system in Palestine.
And it's a very heartbreaking story. And just as a last question, Doctor, what would you like to see from the movement in general? You mentioned unity among Palestinians everywhere, and that's a beautiful thing. What would you like to see going forward from the resistance movement towards the liberation of Palestine?
Yeah, well, liberation is a right, obviously. We all have the right to live in freedom and dignity on our own land. We have the right to exercise the fullness of our humanity. In terms of our own struggle, I mean, the struggle continues, as you know, in different shapes and forms. Nonviolent resistance, whether it is the will to stay on the land, to me, is the most important thing. Being able to remain, to defy, not to succumb, not to be defeated in your spirit, not to abandon your rights, and not to relinquish your urge, your drive to be free, singularly and collectively. This is very important. And of course, the most important thing is to be able to withstand all these injustices and pressures, to stay on the land and to maintain your spirit and your commitment.
This escape was the largest and most successful of the last 20 years in Palestine, and therefore the Israelis want to make an example out of the six men. But the simple fact of the matter is that these men are not criminals. Remember, one of them has not even been charged with a crime, let alone convicted, and he spent 2 years in jail. But in the mainstream media, they always insist on using terms like militant or terrorist or whatever else the Israeli government wants to call Palestinians. But what is their crime? Resisting a foreign military occupation which has killed their families and taken their land? And then when they escape from prison, which is a natural human instinct, they are beaten and tortured? These men are freedom fighters by definition. Everyone has the right under international law to resist a foreign military occupation, including Palestinians. This is spelled out very clearly under international law by the United Nations, the Geneva Convention. These men, like all Palestinians, have extraordinary resilience and courage not to give up after all that they've been through. And to pull off such an escape, they not only freed themselves, but raised the morale of all and gave hope to millions of Palestinians also living under occupation. Whether the Israelis capture one or capture all six, at the end of the day, what these men did at Gilboa was a victory for the resistance front, which cannot be taken away. Regardless of the outcome, the simple fact is that these men liberated themselves from the cruel imprisonment of the occupier, and that is a victory in and of itself. The fact that they did this with a rusty spoon makes it all the more incredible. As a matter of fact, people started throwing spoons at the Israeli embassy in Washington in a show of solidarity with them. And in another show of support, Hamas recently announced that there will be no more prisoner exchanges with Israel without the six men from Gilboa. So in essence, whether the Israelis like it or not, those six men will be free, one way or another. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. 20 years ago, with almost no debate, the U.S. became a fortress state focused on limiting the rights of immigrants in the name of national security. As a result, the U.S. has the world's largest immigration detention system. And the federal government continues to throw billions of dollars at federal agencies and prison profiteers, imperiling hundreds of thousands of immigrants each year. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by CLK Shah, Executive Director of Detention Watch Network. This article is published under the heading, Number of Immigrants Detained by ICE Has Increased 70% Under Biden. Stay tuned for more. When President Biden took office, the number of immigrants in federal custody was at a 20-year low. This was an opportunity to roll back the system, but Biden chose to maintain the status quo of previous administrations. Within a couple of months, jail beds started filling up again. In response, a coalition of groups organized a community's Not Cages Day of Action on September 23rd in over 20 cities across the U.S. to shut down all immigration jails, demand an end to deportations, and release all people currently in immigration custody. 20 years ago, with almost no debate, the U.S. became a fortress state focused on limiting the rights of immigrants in the name of national security. In the wake of 9/11, every aspect of the existing immigration enforcement infrastructure expanded, from immigration agents to immigrant jails, euphemistically referred to as detention centers, and miles of border wall. Since then, over 5.8 million people have been imprisoned in U.S. immigration jails. U.S. policymakers have converted immigrants into numbers and have used quotas to set arbitrary detention and deportation targets, obliterating the value of human life. Congress and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, have obsessively implemented quotas to incentivize immigration enforcement. In 2009, Democratic Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia inserted a bed mandate into the federal appropriations bill stating that ICE is required to maintain a level of not less than 33,400 detention beds. In recent years, ICE has become so fixated on quotas that it has embedded them into contracts, even though the overall numbers of immigrants in detention plummeted during the pandemic, which means the federal government was paying for empty beds. With Joe Biden in office, there is a growing perception that immigration enforcement is less lethal, but the numbers tell a different story. The number of immigrants jailed by ICE has increased 70% since the start of the Biden administration. And the U.S. continues to lock up children, nearly 15,000 daily, in large-scale facilities and military bases. These conditions have been exacerbated by the pandemic. ICE has done little to keep COVID-19 at bay, spreading infections not only inside immigration jails, but also in surrounding communities and to other countries through deportation of thousands of immigrants. Although ICE was forced to release some people during the worst days of the pandemic, they're now beginning to fill immigration jails up again, just as COVID-19 variants continue to take lives. Now is the moment to intervene and reverse course before Biden allows the immigration detention system to reach maximum capacity. People navigating their immigration cases should be able to do so with their families and in community, not behind bars in immigration jails. Now is the time to push Biden to turn things around and hold him to his word. The expansion of immigration detention and the targeting of immigrants reflects the priorities and decisions of both Republican and Democratic administrations going back over more than 20 years. The creation of the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, after 9/11 consolidated power across multiple federal agencies and normalized the idea that immigrants are a security threat. The so-called war on terror has not only wreaked havoc overseas, but also on immigrant communities across the U.S. and all those seeking asylum at U.S. borders. As a result, the U.S. has the world's largest immigration detention system, and the federal government continues to throw billions of dollars at federal agencies and prison profiteers, imperiling hundreds of thousands of immigrants each year. While the legal groundwork for immigrant exclusion preceded the attacks, the 9/11 created the political and institutional will to build up the massive border enforcement and deportation apparatus the U.S. has today. During the Bush administration, the immigration detention system operated much like so-called black sites, with over 350 detention facilities in use, mostly local jails, and little information about how to find immigrants disappeared into these facilities who were being transferred frequently. The Obama administration increased the use of programs like 287G, in which local police act as immigration enforcers and secure communities where immigration data is shared between law enforcement agencies. By doing so, the Obama administration made the machinery of detention and deportation more effective, helping to earn him the moniker Deporter-in-Chief. Obama also expanded the use of large-scale private prisons and built much of the system that Trump unleashed. On the campaign trail, President Biden lamented the separation of families by Trump and committed to stop corporations from profiting off of incarceration. Early on, the administration rolled out reforms to limit deportations and undo Trump's worst policies. But as the border has become a top news story and an easy target for right-wing attacks, Biden has faltered. Meaningful progress toward dismantling immigration detention has effectively ground to a halt. The continued persistence of immigration detention, despite growing consensus that it's unnecessary and wasteful, shows how much easier it is to build up and expand the system and infrastructure than to roll it back. Biden's early moves on detention and private prisons should not be overlooked. DHS publicly ended contracts at two abysmal jails in Georgia and Massachusetts that had received considerable activist attention. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, in a congressional hearing earlier this year, stated there was an overuse of detention, and Biden issued an executive order to phase out the Department of Justice, DOJ, use of private prisons. But despite those moves, Biden has backtracked. Earlier this summer, the DOJ argued against a California law that would ban private prisons in the state, contradicting his own administration's stated priorities. Subsequently, it was also revealed that a shuttered DOJ private prison in Pennsylvania will be converted into a new ICE jail, raising questions about the administration's commitment to downsizing ICE's footprint. We know that the policy decisions made in the wake of 9/11 led to unimaginable suffering, both in the United States and abroad. Swift and substantive reforms to end the immigration detention system in its entirety are necessary to begin to reverse the demonization of immigrants and ensure that another anti-immigrant administration won't be able to undo the changes in the future. Now is the time for Congress to drastically reduce ICE's budget and release people from detention. 9/11 provided cover for the expansion of the immigration enforcement apparatus. Biden has the opportunity to begin to dismantle it. To do so, he must end immigration detention.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths, and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did. And very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Allen was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson's got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up, and I'll be moaning and crying and moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified, the sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls were an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks, they had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Not certainly not, and certainly not 30 and